Welcome to Energy Current. I'm Zhao Wang. U.S.-China climate collaboration is a crucial issue when we talk about tackling climate crisis. However, the bilateral relationship has been declining in the recent years, particularly since 2020. Under such a difficult situation, where will the U.S.-China climate collaboration go? The G7 summit in Japan last week gave a clear message that the seven most developed economies led by the U.S. will coordinate their industrial policy to pursue a more effective decarbonization pathway together. By distancing China, even make China angry, I think this move seems to make the climate and energy collaboration between these two countries even more challenging. Today, we have a guest, Dr. Joanna Lewis. Joanna Lewis is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of Energy and Environment and the Director of the Science, Technology and International Affairs Program at Georgetown University. She has two decades of experience working on climate and energy policy with a focus on China and the US. At Georgetown, she runs the Clean Energy and Climate Research and Group and leads several dialogues facilitating the two countries' climate change engagement. She has a new book just released by MIT Press. The title is Cooperating for the Climate, Learning from International Partnerships in China's Clean Energy Sector. Dr. Lewis, welcome to Energy Current.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, let's start. I'm very interesting about your new book. So what's the key question you want to answer in this book? And what are your main findings from your research?
Yeah, so, you know, I really wanted to write this book to understand and really to document how countries have been cooperating with China on clean energy and climate change over the past three decades. You know, as we know, this is something that's been going on for a long time, but there's actually been very little written about bilateral cooperation with China in this space, and very little assessment of it. So, you know, the questions I was trying to answer with this book are, you know, not just how countries have been cooperating with China over the past three decades, but how they manage the risks and benefits of such collaboration. And then finally, what can we learn from, you know, this past cooperation in order to inform decisions about bilateral cooperation today? Of course, you know, in the time we're in right now, where I sit in Washington, you know, there's increasing tensions between Washington and Beijing. Cooperation doesn't look the same way it did, you know, even 10 years ago. But I think it's important. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is to really show, you know, why cooperation was meaningful in the past and how we may be able to make it meaningful again by learning from past experience. So in terms of some of the key findings of this book, you know, I document how China has, in fact, been the primary target of international clean energy cooperation over the last few decades, even as this is beginning to shift, you know, because of China's role in global climate change and in the energy system. It is just really a key bilateral partner, you know, with countries all around the world. And what I also found is that this cooperation has taken place along a continuum of political and technological benefit that really varies by country. And there's some distinct differences in how different countries have framed their cooperation with China and in terms of the motivations that brings them to the table. I find that, you know, we see less cooperation in certain clean energy technology areas that are key for the low carbon transition, driven primarily by competitiveness concerns. And again, what that technology is has changed over time. And one of the things I try to do in this book is to measure, to whatever extent it's possible, outcomes from some of the cooperation efforts, and particularly those that had multi-year, multi-stakeholder investment. And finally, you know, I think another key finding is that China, that really we see now technology and know-how is no longer flowing to China, you know, from the industrialized countries, but also from China, because China is now really leading much of the world in terms of clean energy technology development. And so, you know, this is implications not just for how we design bilateral cooperation going forward, but also just broader implications for how science and technology and how China's, you know, emerging sophistication in these sectors shapes global power politics, and particularly now in, you know, geopolitics of clean energy and clean energy supply chains.
Thank you. Very helpful to understand the whole book's main findings. I just want to touch on one of the major issues you just mentioned. It is about the clean energy technology competitiveness. You know, if we dig into the very important parts of that competitiveness, if I can say there are maybe three parts. First one is the intellectual property rights. Second one is the international supply chain security. The third one, I think, is the industrial scale or manufacturing scale. Among these three major components of the competitiveness, I think China are good at two things. The first about the scaling up. The industrial scale and the economic size, it's very strong in China to make something cheaper or low cost. That's the one of the reasons people argue that China is one of the biggest contributors to the declining cost of the renewable energy technology. Although in the beginning, European countries and even US pay the high cost, particularly Germany and other Western European countries, pay the high cost of the solar PV and wind power, giving China opportunity to scale up by technology transfer and by collaboration. But, you know, international supply chain security is a big concern, not only for China and also for other industrial countries. So I want you to talk about international supply chain in the clean energy, like the electric vehicles, like other solar PV. And second point is about the intellectual property rights, like the core technology, or the very high-end technology. Because in the wind power and the solar PV, many people say, okay, the very high-end technology are still kept by G7 countries. China hasn't in the process catching up. So do you like to give us your observation about these two points? One is the supply chain security. The other is about the high-end technology.
Yeah, maybe I'll go in reverse order. I mean, I think on the question of intellectual property, first of all, it, you know, really is a changing landscape over the last two decades, where originally it's, as you said, and as my first book was about, which, you know, chronicled the rise of China's wind power industry. Really, we saw, you know, Chinese firms acquire intellectual property that was originally developed primarily in Germany, the United States, and elsewhere, and then use that to expand upon their designs. And that was because China was starting from, as you say, a sort of a lagging technological position, but both through their manufacturing scale as well as major investments in R&D, you know, we really do see very few areas where China is lagging at this point, and even some areas where they're leading the world, you know, namely in batteries for electric vehicles and electric vehicle technology more broadly. This is really an area where, you know, as discussed now quite frequently in Washington, where, you know, the United States and others really want to try to regain some competitiveness, you know, vis-a-vis the real, you know, advanced technologies and investments that China's made in this area. And so that's where, you know, the supply chain issue starts to come in. This is something I don't talk about much in the book, because again, this is a relatively new issue. I would say sort of coming out of the pandemic is really, you know, there's been a lot of focus on this, and particularly with the passage of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, here in the United States, which is, you know, really this sort of resurgence of green industrial policy and sort of the United States moving towards using this sort of legislation to build locally manufactured clean energy supply chains. And really, this is, you know, the first major effort that we've seen the U.S. do this, even though we've sort of dabbled in it in the past. This is, of course, something China has done for a long time, in many of its clean energy sectors, as well as other sectors. So, you know, I think in the supply chain space, this is, you know, very much an open question of what's going to happen here. You know, the United States is looking at how to de-risk supply chains from being overly dependent on any one country. But in the clean energy space, that country is for the most part China. China controls the vast majority of supply chain components in solar, wind, battery, you know, technologies, which are sort of the three main ones, you know, that we're looking at in this country. And so I think the real question is sort of what, you know, there's real trade-offs between every country locally manufacturing their own domestic technology and our ability to meet global climate goals by deploying technology as quickly and as cheaply as possible. It's going to cost more if supply chains move out of China. There's sort of no way around that. And so I think policymakers need to be strategic about any industrial policy that gets implemented and any trade policy that gets implemented in the coming months and weeks and years, you know, surrounding this sort of decoupling or de-risking of supply chains, and just make sure that we're doing this in a way that doesn't jeopardize global climate goals, and also just doesn't make technology more expensive for the countries, you know, particularly that need it, the more vulnerable countries and, you know, throughout the global South.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes we think about the access to the raw materials for the clean energy in the electric vehicles and others. It's really a tricky issue. We may think the inclusiveness or exclusiveness when some countries like China step in the first place and holding the power, but other countries want to catch up, they have concern about the supply chain. Because sometimes we see some cases like China stop supplying the rare earth to Japan under some international tension. And so this is kind of commercial or trading debate. But I want to touch another very big, very important issue about the international clean energy collaboration. You know, how to measure the productivity of the international collaboration is an essential issue. In the book, you have three case studies. The case of the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center is the only one, not only covering a variety of clean energy technology, but also producing some quantitative and impactful commercial outcome from the collaboration between two countries. But as you mentioned, the international intellectual property rights is one of the key issues which U.S. Partners have high concern. And also Chinese partners, they also want to gain some advantages by working with U.S. partners. So what do you think the most important lessons on the protecting intellectual property from the U.S.-China case?
Yeah, so I, you know, in the book, I talk, as you mentioned, about three different clean energy research centers between China and three different countries, the United States, Denmark, and Brazil. And all of these centers have different structures. They have different, you know, mechanisms for how they were formed. Some are physical, some are virtual, you know, but the CERC, as you mentioned, the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center, is somewhat unique in, you know, in bilateral cooperation with China, in that this was an effort that spanned really over a decade. It spanned, you know, two presidential administrations in the United States, you know, and it, you mentioned intellectual property. What was really unique about this partnership is that it addressed intellectual property head on. So intellectual property is, of course, always sort of a lingering issue in the background of almost every bilateral arrangement that involves technology, right? But what was unique about the CERC is that coming in, this was, you know, this involved on the US side, the Department of Energy, on the Chinese side, Ministry of Science and Technology, as well as NDRC, NEA, you know, and but particularly most in DOE sort of took the lead on, you know, getting their lawyers and their, you know, their ministers or secretaries involved to hash out a specific agreement on intellectual property. They call this the technology management plan. And there was a technology management plan signed for the entire partnership, as well as for each of the consortia that were involved that focused on different technology areas. And everyone who was involved, you know, so this was something negotiated at the highest levels, you know, between the US and China. And I actually was able to sit in on some of these negotiations, you know, with the lawyers from the China Ministry of Science and Technology and from the DOE side. And, you know, here are the concerns on both sides and here are the compromises that were made and reached. And, you know, what was really done here was just sort of setting some rules of engagement regarding intellectual property so that everyone would feel comfortable, because remember, this was a public-private partnership as well. So it involved not just government entities, but national laboratories, private companies, you know, who all were coming to the table with different sorts of background, intellectual property and knowledge and know-how. And so what the technology management plan did is it just clarified how that background IP would be treated. It clarified how anything jointly developed would be handled, how any improvements on technology would be handled. And we had many training sessions and workshops involving IP experts from both countries and who know IP law in both China and the United States and know them together and sort of where things are different. So, you know, a lot of like American lawyers who work in China and vice versa, right? And this really allowed us to sit down, you know, with research, you know, basically we would have researchers and lawyers all in the same room and government officials and private companies. And we would talk through, you know, what were the concerns and how could they be handled in the context of this partnership. And you know, I've seen a lot of these partnerships play out. I'd never seen anything like this, you know, just so much attention and focus and resources specifically on the IP issue. And I just think it was really valuable because when you speak, you know, and I interviewed a lot of the companies who were involved, you know, particularly from the United States. And there were multiple situations where they were able to rely on the CERC and its IP provisions to, you know, enforce or help to negotiate or resolve some kind of disagreement over IP that, you know, a US and a Chinese partner had, for example, over operations. So, you know, I think this was a really valuable experience of the CERC. And, you know, I've tried to really document a lot of this in the book and in some other work I've written, you know, about this sort of IP arrangement and how it was really quite novel at the time and how it really, I think, has a lot of useful lessons learned and can serve as an example for other sorts of bilateral and multilateral agreements that involve technology and sort of, you know, it really is like a best practice of how to be more transparent about how IP will be treated and sort of make sure, as you say, there's this trust going in because the rules have been clarified, you know, and there's just not, it gets rid of the ambiguity and I think makes everyone more comfortable to come to the table with, you know, potentially valuable information.
I know under some international security tension, like Taiwan and other issues, and Chinese counterparts of U.S. climate negotiation leadership, like Secretary Kerry, have no access to his counterparts in dialogue if something happened during on the sensitive issues like international security. So this is a quite different ideology or mentality. In China, leadership, maybe they think everything is connected. If you want to work with us on climate, you have to work with us on other issues. But for US, they think, okay, this is quite different categories. If we want to address the global challenge like climate change, we need to separate other issues. We have two other channels, a platform to address to build a consensus or to find solutions. So these two very different mentality, different philosophy, do you think it's also a very big challenge for the future collaboration between China and US on climate?
I mean, I think there's a lot of challenges, you know, facing the future of US-China cooperation on climate change. You know, I think, you know, the last year when Speaker Pelosi, you know, then Speaker Pelosi traveled to Taiwan and then, you know, a series of dialogues were put on hold, including the US-China climate working group. I think, you know, the feeling of US policymakers was, I think, you know, it was understood sort of why China was doing this, certainly. But I think that the feeling was, why would China withhold cooperation on climate change, which is something, you know, not just beneficial for China and the US, but for the entire planet, right? The entire world. And so I think US policymakers looked at that and said, you know, it's not that they didn't understand why these issues are interconnected, because I think they are increasingly interconnected. I think for a long time, you know, those of us in the climate space sort of thought we were insulated from the broader tensions of the relationship. But I think as climate change is increasingly, it's not just a scientific issue, it's not just a technical issue, you know, it is about competitiveness, it's about geopolitics, it's about, you know, trade, you know, and so I don't think you can just disentangle climate and energy cooperation from the broader relationship. And I think American policymakers understand that. But again, it's about, you know, why can't we find a way to work together given the constraints that we have and given the, you know, the broader economic and security challenges, you know, that the relationship is facing, right? And so I think, you know, the constructive approach would be that, you know, we design cooperation mechanisms that take into account these shifting geopolitical environments, you know, and take into account economic and security concerns and essentially design around them, you know, because, you know, I think they're not going to go away. And so we shouldn't assume that like we can cooperate when things are good and then we stop cooperating when things are bad, right? I think we should just assume things are going to be turbulent. And that's just the background context. But if it's really in China's interest to continue to engage in this space with the United States and other countries, and I do believe it is, and I do believe Chinese policymakers think it is, then I don't think this is something that should be kind of stopped, you know, out of retaliation or whatever. It's just too important an issue. And so, you know, it's not like a reward for the United States to engage. I think it's more like, what are we both doing respectively, domestically on climate change, because the rest of the world wants to know what we're doing. And if we can work together, that's great, because that really sends a very positive signal to the rest of the world. And if we can't work together, then I think we're, you know, we have a much bigger challenge just about the future of our ability to address climate change in any effective way, because you ultimately need the US and China in the room, and you need these two countries on the same page, you know, to the greatest extent possible.
Yeah, I think this is true in the past two or three decades in global climate governance, particularly when China's economy is booming continually year after year, decade after decade. But many people argue, particularly after the Inflation Reduction Act in the US came out, maybe the strategic competitiveness between two countries has become one of the mainstream strategy. On the one hand, the US is still open. We hope China is also open to collaborate. But on the other hand, maybe US, by working with other members of the G7 and other allies to produce pressure, policy pressure, industrial development pressure to China. And the IRA is a very typical example, like the US lesson learned from China's experience. But it's interesting for the US to work with other countries and to produce its own vision and also action to produce pressure and letting China feel the strong pressure from other countries. It's not like we have to work with you in an older form, but we need to compete in order to develop our economies and increase our trading relations and provide more employment. In this case, I think, do you think it's even more effective or productive than the previous version or previous collaboration?
I mean, look, it remains to be seen. You know, I think that, I mean, China has some real challenges right now domestically, you know, not just sort of economically and coming out of the pandemic, but, you know, in terms of climate change and the coal transition, you know, we see, of course, you know, coal growth has been accelerating in recent years, you know, more coal power plants being built despite very ambitious policies on the books, you know, to peak emissions and to achieve carbon neutrality, right, by 2060. And, you know, it's at some point, right, like that China's going to have to figure out what role coal is going to play, right, in its energy system. And, it's going to require a significant transition of not just technologically, but socially, you know, in terms of employment, in terms of restructuring you know, some of the largest, you know, SOEs and, you know, the coal industry being one of the largest employers, you know, within China. So, you know, I think there's just a lot of challenging issues to be sorted out. And I do think that these are the kind of conversations, right, that we could be having.
So you, in your book, you mentioned China also outreach other countries, particularly some countries in Global South, to help them to reduce their carbon intensity of economy. And China, Brazil is one of the cases. But I want to ask, do you have any other cases like China with other Global South countries in helping them reduce reliance on coal?
You know, we see a lot of bilateral partnerships between China and other developing countries. You know, they, you know, as this is sort of part of their broader South-South cooperation agenda, which, you know, is talked about quite a bit under China's UNFCCC sort of commitments. But really dominating China's engagement with the developing world has been the Belt and Road Initiative and the broader, you know, I mean, until recently, China was, you know, the largest source of energy infrastructure investments through much of the Global South, including some of the countries you mentioned, you know, and China was for the most part helping to finance coal plants in across Southeast Asia, across, you know, parts of Africa. So I think the real shift has been in the Belt and Road Initiative specifically. And, you know, you mentioned the pledge that President Xi made in the fall of 2021 to stop investing in coal plants abroad. I mean, I think even before that announcement, there was this really growing international pressure on China to stop financing these coal plants, but also pressure starting to come from the host countries where a lot of these investments are being made and just sort of less and less appetite for coal investments due to climate risk, due to sort of, you know, a set of other concerns. So, you know, I think we are starting to see this shift in Chinese finance abroad, but a lot of it has really declined substantially, just the amount of overseas investment. I think we're expecting to see it ramp up as kind of operations resume post-COVID. But I think the real question is, what is that portfolio going to look like? How much of it's going to be in cleaner energy technologies? You know, what role? Of course, China is very well positioned to be a major player in helping the developing world develop wind and solar and other technologies, since it's itself is the global leader in deploying and manufacturing these technologies. But in the research I've done, for example, looking at sort of China's operations, like solar power operations around the world, you know, to some extent, it's manufacturing in other countries or it's exporting, but it's not really transferring technology to these countries. You know, it's essentially doing it themselves. And so these are, of course, you know, a lot of these countries want to do what China did and build up their own domestic capacity. They don't want to be reliant entirely on China for imports. So I think, again, this is part of these broader supply chain discussions and sourcing discussions. And it's going to be, I think, interesting to see what role China plays going forward in potentially disseminating, you know, renewables to throughout the developing world.
Great. The last question about the new summit in Japan about G7 meeting, annual summit. And from that meeting, we know that the G7 countries, the most developed economies around the world, they want to talk to each other about their concerns, particularly from other members apart from US, because US IRA has produced some worry to the other countries about the trading, like Japan, the European Union, because that policy really gave the initiative, economic and other financial initiative, the local manufacturing companies. But now they are trying to collaborate to share the similar policy mechanism, similar policy initiatives, trying to build, as I've seen, is kind of a community that share similar values and also similar mission on the climate to try to benefit each other. So that move, I think, is kind of distancing China from this collective move. How do you understand the action, the policy implication from the G7 summit in Japan on this issue?
So as I understand it, I mean, there were essentially two statements that are sort of relevant here and, you know, have in some ways a little bit contradictory. So one is the statement on economic resilience and economic security. And the other is the statement, the G7 Clean Energy Economy Action Plan, right? And so, you know, the action plan is about reaffirming, you know, commitment to the Paris Agreement, because of course, in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war, we've seen this resurgence in fossil fuels across, particularly across the European continent, you know, which for the most part had been really leading the push to decarbonize, but just real concerns about energy security, you know, have been causing countries to move in the other direction. And so, you know, we essentially see this sort of statement, you know, but it's not as strong as some past statements. And then you see both here and in the other document, this discussion of establishing resilient supply chains, right? And I, you know, it's very interesting, right? Because I think even just among the G7 nations, not everyone is on the same page with exactly what this means. And, you know, I think there's just a lot to be resolved still about what does that really mean and what are we going to allow? I mean, in the United States, right, very actively, you know, the IRA calls for, in order to get sort of all the incentives under the IRA, you have to locally manufacture a bunch of these, the technologies for electric vehicles, for example, or for solar panels. But it wasn't clear until recently, you know, for example, like, you know, do you have to have an American owned company manufacture these, or can a Korean company set up in the United States? Can a Chinese company set up a factory in the United States, right? I mean, these are sort of real questions that are being addressed on a case by case basis right now, but it's not very, there's not a lot of clarity, and, you know, investors need clarity, and they need sort of long-term time horizons, they need stability. And so I think there's just still a lot to be sorted out here. I mean, I agree that, you know, a lot of this, I'm sure China looks at a lot of this and says, okay, so, you know, what is our role in these supply chains? And, you know, why are we sort of being ganged up upon here? But I think that, you know, it's much more useful to engage China in these conversations, because I think that, you know, as I understand it from Chinese colleagues, a lot of these conversations are happening within China as well about how China can ensure secure supply chains, given all the turbulence in the world and the fact that they are also reliant on a variety of other countries for their own clean energy manufacturing. So, you know, I think that these are big conversations that have to happen. I think they're not easy. I think very few countries have sort of fully understand sort of the consequences of putting in place these policies. You know, I think already it's very unclear if the United States can achieve the local manufacturing goals that the IRA has set out. I think it's great to have an ambitious target and to mobilize local manufacturing, but I really don't see how we can meet global climate goals in the time horizon that we need to if China does not, you know, remain a key part of the clean energy supply chain. So I think there is going to be a huge scaling in these technologies. We're going to be increasing these supply chains around the world, the amount of production that we need. And so there is a place for many other players to enter these sectors without necessarily taking away from China, right? I mean, we're going to see huge growth. And it's much easier to think about how you restructure a growth industry than you know, an industry that is declining. So I think it's exciting that many countries are thinking about this. But I think, you know, we need to be having smart and strategic conversations about how to do this in a way that is in the interest of local economies, national security, but also doesn't forget that we need to deploy these technologies as quickly and as cheaply as possible.
Yes, I think so. It's quite challenging. And finally, we have a routine just asking our speaker, our guest, to share a book he or she just read and find very inspirational or impressive.
Oh, well, let's see. I mean, most of what I read, right, are sort of climate and energy and China books. But occasionally, when I have time, you know, to read something a bit lighter, one of my favorite genres of book to read are sort of food writers, like, you know, and particularly I like when people write about Chinese cooking and traveling throughout China, because I've, you know, of course, had the chance to live and work in China and travel and in, you know, always try to recreate the cuisine at home. So I'm actually rereading a book that I read many years ago when I was living in China by Jen Lin Liu called Serve the People, A Stir-Fried Journey Through China, which documents her sort of time studying in Chinese cooking schools. And she had actually set up a cooking school in Beijing that I used to attend quite frequently, you know, when I needed a break from work to, you know, and you, it gives, you know, mostly foreigners and sort of others, you know, a chance to sort of study with local Chinese chefs and learn about Chinese cooking. So that's just sort of a hobby of mine. And she's actually now working at a restaurant here in Washington, D.C. So I had the chance to meet her in person recently. And I know she's working on a new book right now. So I look forward to hearing about that.
It's interesting, very interesting. I can see the climate solutions also comes from our dieting. You know, when we notice about our plant-based dieting can really make great contribution. Not only totally we become vegetarian or vegan, but we can choose 1 or 2 days or 1 or 2 meals just eat plant-based food. That will be very helpful. Thank you so much for your insights and your opinion and also your research. And that's Keep In Touch. We hope you have a chance in the future to learn from your new research.
Great, thank you so much.